Good evening. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. And along with K2 Kilo Echo Yankee, his name is Mel. Mel and Dick try to organize a thing called the Technical Net. It's a gathering of amateur radio operators who would like to know how the stuff works, how to make it work better, what's the better brands, although we don't necessarily recommend brands, but people will tell each other their personal experience as to what they've done, how well it has worked, and what they did to modify it in some cases. It's kind of a school, and all you have to do to be a student at this school is just to have an interest in the subject. And ham radio operators are curious people. They have interest in many things. Not only ham radio and computers, which are tightly aligned to each other. They occasionally get into discussions of the latest article in QST magazine and what does it mean and how do I understand it. Or occasionally they get into things like amateur television or digital television or how do we stop the oil flow in the Gulf of Mexico. Any interest, any subject of interest to ham radio operators is appropriate for the Technical Net. A person signs into the Technical Net because he has a question or a comment by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. A typical sign-in would sound like this, WS2N, Paul, and yes. Do we have any check-ins at this time? Please give me your call letters and your name. Remember to wait for the beep, K2RIW in the TechNet.
November 2, X-ray Juliet, November, yes.
Kilo Charlie 2, Yankee David Tango. The name is Matt, and yes.
WHYY Joe, comment, yes.
And this is K2KEY. Dick, before we start, could I say something for later on?
N2RDB, Tim, no.
KC2, Yankee David Tango. Matt, yes.
So far we've got Wesley, Matt, Joe, Tim, and Mel. Mel, go ahead with your statement.
Okay, this is K2KEY. As you know, we were discussing for weeks these different verticals that have come up on the market. Kind of pricey piece of pipe. And I've been inundated with questions about which one to purchase, and so on and so forth, you know, brands and everything. And I finally think I've got somewhat of an elegant answer for those who would like to try it at little or no cost, Dick. So if we can leave a little time, later on I could outline something of very much interest to these people. I told them the best way is to listen. And we'll have a discussion on how to homebrew, simply homebrew one of these verticals, and get an idea. So you'll be able to get an idea for, I could say, little or no cost on how one performs. Dick, over.
Very fine. Now, normally we lately have switched over at 9 o'clock to answering the emails because beginners who are getting into ham radio. Some of them are younger people who have to go to bed at an early hour to go to school the next morning. So rather than hold them off until midnight, so to speak, where they can't stay that late, so we will be switching over at 9 o'clock. Also, when it comes to the latest issue of QST Magazine, the July issue, 2010, on page 55 is a nice article by Joel Hallis, Whiskey One Zulu Romeo, which gives a reasonably nice explanation of the difference between a horizontal dipole and a quarter wave vertical antenna, and it describes the difference in performance, and left-handedly you can tell quite a bit about what amount of resources are required to establish each one of these antennas and which one gives you the biggest bang for the dollar. And he used as an example a horizontal dipole that's 40 feet off the ground, as opposed to a much lower, I guess it was a 16-foot long vertical. Both of these are on 20 meters. And it gives a very nice comparison showing the patterns, gains, and whatever. I'm going to be writing Joel a letter pretty soon, an email, with reference to the circular polarization diagram. We won't be discussing circular polarization tonight, but I do have a comment that I want to make to Joel on that particular subject. So that's something we've got to look forward to. So once again, we've already got Wesley, Matt, Joe, and Tim. Anyone else who wanted to sign in that didn't get a chance to yet, please give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes if you have a question or a comment. Give that to me right now. K2RIW on the TechNet.
K2RIW, this is KC2, Yankee David Tango. Rick, if you can put me to the end of questions, I would appreciate it. I just got home and the alarm is going off, so I'm going to have to deal with that, but I will be listening. And hopefully, when everyone's done with their questions, I'll be able to join back in. This is Kilo Charlie 2, Yankee David Tango, clear.
Very fine, Matt. We'll put you at the end. So other than Wesley, Matt, Joe, and Tim, anyone else to sign in? Give me your call letters and name at this time. K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WYQ, and my name is Mike.
And Mike, you will or will not have a question or a comment for us?
I really don't know enough about what you guys talk about. So, I don't know what to say. I'm a new ham and I'm having, you know, some trouble. And so, it's hard for me.
Well, you're in good company, Mike. We all started out that way. One way to learn to swim is to be thrown into the river, so to speak. It's not the recommended way. Make sure you're wearing a life preserver. My recommendation is you sit and listen and ask questions when you feel like it. Don't worry about whether or not your question is what you think is not an intelligent question. Don't worry about that. But by listening and hear people talk, at first the vocabulary will scare you and it will sound kind of foreign, but eventually some of it will start making sense. So hang in there. It's an extremely good educational hobby. You'll use it for the rest of your life if you desire to do so. And so the sooner you start learning, the better it will be later on, Mike. So hang in there. You're going to be a little bit frustrated. Anybody learning new material is going to be frustrated. You can be a guy with a high IQ going to the best college there is, and you sit there in front of a real good professor. In the beginning, he's telling you all kinds of things you've never heard before. You haven't heard the vocabulary. You haven't seen those equations before. You don't know the way he expresses himself. You don't know the way he does his homework. And it's quite frustrating in the beginning. Anybody who's gone to a school has experienced some of that. So it's kind of normal. And as I said, you're in good company. The first person who signed in with a real question or a comment is the man who's setting up one hell of a testing laboratory there in Queens, is Wesley. So what's the latest, Wesley? At least a week has gone by. You must have acquired at least one or two more pieces of test equipment. N2XJM, K2RIW in the TechNet.
How am I coming out? Am I coming good?
You sound about as beautiful as a European can sound, Wesley. Go ahead.
Okay, this is November to X-ray Juliet November. Two things. Yes, I did acquire some stuff. I've lost a truck because my record on eBay shows 49, and 49, and I believe that I have 59. It's just that it shows within 1 month how many devices I have purchased. So, but yes, I've got a quite good equipment. I had a pleasure, and I would like to point it, of Eric visiting me. Great man. And absolutely amazingly great mind. But this is my opinion in this matter. Let me drop. Okay. About a month ago, probably a little bit more, I have promised you that since I announced that I've changed myself and I am going to prove whether the free energy devices work or not. I'm going to give you information about it, disregard the fact whether it works or not. I have a team of people. One is in Moscow, one is in Gdańsk, Poland, and one is in New York. So we have three laboratories right now, and three people, the same parts, the same schematics, and we're working on a Tesla device. The two principles is to power the device from the battery, could be 9-volt battery, within the period of 3 seconds, disconnect the battery, the device works by itself, powering from anywhere from 150 watts to 5 kilowatts of power. With no external source of energy, the only what it needs the ground. Let me drop. And so far I'm in a stage that I was able to achieve the generation circuitry, and I have the spark that is actually sparking, and the frequency of that spark is approximately supposed to be 20 kilohertz, but my oscilloscope for some reason shows anywhere from 1 megahertz to 26 megahertz. The pattern is very much unique. It's a ringing pattern, and I can send you the pictures of it. Anyhow, the part in Poland was able actually to reach over unity. Now, if it's true or it's not, I do not claim that. I'm trying to repeat the same in my place, and then I will tell you what is really going on. Let me drop. One thing for sure that I can say is that my device that I have in here on the desk, with very small power, was able to completely disturb my solder gun, actually not the solder, the pump in the solder gun, reacting very, very weird way. All of the electronic multimeters do not want to measure the voltage from the secondary coil, which is supposed to be in within no more than 200 volts. I have a Hess, Clark Hess, that's the laboratory, very expensive equipment, up to 1000 volts. And the voltage on the transformer is, on the sparking part of it, is no more than 4000 volts. I was able to achieve it from the high voltage probe and oscilloscope, but the probe is not calibrated and looks like somebody played with it before I purchased it. Okay. On the spectrum analyzer, I saw that I have something strange. Is the geometrical pattern growth of... I have the stronger signal, 1.5 megahertz, then I have 3 megahertz, then I have 12, then I have 6 megahertz, then I have 12 megahertz, and I have 24 megahertz. And of course, this go on and on, but my spectrum analyzer is only to 40 megahertz, so I was able to listen to that on my Kenwich 2000. Well, it goes up to 70 centimeters, showing the signal. Let me drop. Now, the results that we've got from Gdańsk, from Poland, is that we didn't loop the over-unity. The simple idea is actually, if there is any over-unity, take the part of that over-unity factor, loop it back, and make the device work by itself. I could remind you the strange effect of the amplifier. When it goes to self-oscillation, the self-oscillation actually creates the tube damage. And I remember the comment of Eric when he said that this is kind of something strong. So I thought that if that would be something that will protect the, like a refrigerating that will protect the tubes before burning, I mean, so the tubes don't burn that quick, would be able to observe this effect similar way. Let me drop. Okay, now, what that person was able to achieve was by delivering small amount of power. Let's say, he is not perfectly sure, but let's say that was 10 watts, he was able to achieve 200 watts. So the light bulb was able to light up. Now, whether this is kind of misunderstanding of certain things, or this is true, I cannot say, because if you take the Tesla coil, the Tesla generator, and you take the light bulb, electrical light bulb, in your hands, it will light up. So, in being connected only one side, so that might be forcing factor. My question to you is that I have a very much strange pattern on the oscilloscope, ringing pattern, and I gotta send these images to you. But my question is, what is the safe way to have a measurement, precise measurement of the high voltage up, let's say 10 kilovolts, without using digital meters? So back to you, and I'm waiting for your comments. And to XJ.
Wow. I'm going to start off telling you, I'm going to give you a bunch of opinions, Wesley. And you're in a very unique area. But I'm going to carry your subjects in the order in which you try to handle your subjects in the order in which you mentioned them. And you did an extremely good job of dropping the carrier periodically so you didn't time out the machine. Your first comment was about Eric, KE2EJ, who visited you. And Eric is an unusual individual, as you can tell. If you picked him out in the crowd, you might not know that he's a guy, you might not associate the person that you see with the person that you heard over the air. There's an extremely good reason that both Channel 13 and Channel 21 PBS television stations in the New York City area chose him to be the chief engineer for those two areas. A guy who has a lot of interest and a lot of experience in the fancy pieces of electronics, particularly broadcast electronics, as well as digital signal processing techniques. So a very unusual individual. Glad you two guys got together. Let me drop. Uh-oh. You want to say something, Eric? What was the meeting of Eric and Wesley like? Your signal's a little bit noisy, but go right ahead, Eric, and give us a couple of comments. Coil of an automobile. When you take a magnetic circuit that's got a primary and secondary winding. Let me drop. And by whatever means...
Okay, to Jack.
And by whatever means you you charge the primary circuit and then create a strong discontinuous current, the inductive kickback can give you very, very high voltages. To measure very, very high voltages in a way that's traceable to the Bureau is extremely difficult. You've already seen evidence of that.
E-J.
Okay, Eric, go ahead. You want to make a comment, Eric?
Hello. Roger, Dick. I just wanted to say I'm with you. Let me turn this down. I'm just way up here in Connecticut. I'm way past Bridgeport. I'm in a place called Milford, Connecticut. And I just wanted to say that, you know, we've got some family listening here while you were talking about me. And I wanted to say to Wesley, that's why the signal's so weak because we're so far away, that I've got a schematic and a manual coming for the LCR meter, so that's going to get taken care of. And the meeting with Wesley was very interesting. And when I get a chance to get you on the side, Dick, I'll tell you all about it. We're going back into the family dinner here, but I just wanted to put my 2 cents worth in. K2RWKE2J through Echo Link.
Very fine, Eric. Sounds like you're having a good time up there with your family. And hope I wasn't misunderstood with some of the things I was trying to say. The measurements you're trying to make, Wesley, are extremely difficult. Lots and lots of people have had trouble in this area. A Tesla coil produces an extremely high and extremely brief voltage, and it creates a corona discharge in air. You get these lightning bolt-like things in air. And once air breaks down because you've exceeded something like 30 volts per centimeter of what's called E field, an extremely nonlinear negative resistance characteristic takes place. You and I have a little bit something in common on this one, in that in my consulting business, I had a client a couple of years ago that needed an analysis of air breakdown. And I went and bought a couple of machines and did some measurements on my own. I did a slightly different method than you did, and I've recently discovered what really goes on. I said what really goes on, that's an exaggeration. I know a little bit more about what takes place when a voltage discharge in air takes place, and it's an extremely difficult thing to measure. So the fact that you've seen all these higher harmonics at 1.5, 3, 6, 12, 24, 48, and whatever megacycles all the way up to 70 centimeters doesn't surprise me. A spark gap or an arc type transmitter was very popular at the turn of the century, the early days of radio. Let me drop. The good news about an arc is that it can, with very simple equipment, generate some extremely high frequencies. That's the good news. Without going through all the amplification of tubes and oscillators and whatever. The bad news is that controlling it, controlling what frequencies it's on, controlling its bandwidth becomes a lot more difficult. It gives you a lot for the money, but quantifying it is not easy. That damped discharge that you see on your oscilloscope is giving you a hint, but the actual Tesla coil itself is an extremely delicate circuit. Under normal circumstances, the high voltage end of it, the upper end of the Tesla coil, if that's what you're using, has an extremely high impedance, and any method of putting instrumentation on there to measure the voltage, the current, the time, or whatever, is going to disturb it. So indirect techniques are probably going to have to be required. In other words, if I put some kind of a voltage probe some significant distance away from the Tesla coil, and if I used some of the laws of physics of inverse square law, for instance, or capacitor divider network, even though one of the capacitors might be 6 inches of air, so to speak, there are ways you can make an indirect measurement as to what is the voltage and frequency present on your Tesla coil, and yet provide minimum loading. A so-called high voltage probe put directly on a Tesla coil is going to be almost violating the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. By that I mean it's going to be disturbing the measurement more than a tolerable amount. And so that's going to be a problem. Now, when it comes to, let me drop. When it comes to the excess energy, the free energy, or whatever, as I said, you're going to be getting some flack from people on that. Don't let that discourage you, because both Wesley and Alex have indicated to me in the past that there's an extremely large number of websites, particularly on YouTube, where people show very elaborate pieces of machinery, and they show very encouraging-looking results that are looking for free energy. And it's time that somebody gets to the bottom of it all, and it looks like a man in Queens is establishing a laboratory by which measurements can be made. When nonlinear phenomena are present, quantifying it becomes a lot more difficult. So you're going to have to run the experiment two or three different ways in order to really find out what's going on. And when it comes to the power going in and the power coming out of machinery that you hope is giving you excess energy, all of those measurements are going to have to be done in a true RMS manner for current, a true RMS manner for voltage. In other words, an ordinary voltmeter and an ordinary ammeter can easily lead you astray. And when it comes to measuring instantaneous power, which is the instantaneous product of current and voltage, including the phase angle between the two, in order to quantify the true power versus the reactive power, you're going to have to go slow and do the experiment a number of times. So what you're trying to do is not easy, as you were well aware ahead of time. And I guess the people in Gdansk, the people in Moscow, and the people in Queens, New York, are going to try to put their heads together with various methods of making the measurements in order to confirm what's really going on. Not easy, but don't be discouraged. Keep hacking at it. I can tell you've got the enthusiasm, you've got the wherewithal. You've got
repeater, timeout, cancel.
You've got the curiosity, and you'll eventually come to a set of answers. And the immediate answers, the first answers you get, might not be the final answer. It may require publishing reports that get peer reviewed. They get corrected, they get argued about, and eventually you'll find out what's really going on. But because there's so darn many people in so darn many countries showing so darn many websites and movies and YouTube videos and whatever, it's time that somebody gets to the bottom of it, and it looks like you and your group of people stand a very good chance of doing that. It ain't going to be easy. Don't give up. I know I didn't give you any direct answers. I may not be able to give you any direct answers. But one other thing I'm going to tell you is that recently, of my 30 so-called physics puzzles that I've collected over the years, in which I subject various engineering people to them because it indicates a place in the normal educational process where the information is not covered in a proper manner so that people can walk away with an easy understanding. And I've collected 30 of these puzzles that that try to indicate that and try to illuminate those areas. The breakdown of air and the way air behaves at the molecular level is very different than common sense. You ask the average person, how fast does an air molecule move? What is its average speed? You'll be amazed the answers you get. What's the size, the speed? The mean spacing between air molecules, the mean distance before they crash into each other, a mean free path and whatever, and what really happens when high voltage in air takes place. It's a very different process than common sense. I've been studying that over the last couple of years. I've come to a couple of conclusions. You and I will eventually be comparing notes along these lines, and maybe the little bit of the information I've gathered on the subject may help you in your concern. I'm not quite sure, though. I've got a question for you, Wesley, and that is the rotary magnetic machines that generate a so-called free energy. Let me drop. And the Tesla coil by which Mr. Tesla thought at the turn of the century he was going to discover a technique by which he could transmit power without wires. A very difficult thing to do, and I'm not even positive it's possible to do it in the way that he had in mind. I'm wondering what in your mind, Wesley, is the relationship between a Tesla coil, if that's the right thing that I'm talking about, versus the rotary magnetic machines that I've seen in the past that seem to be giving up excess energy? What's the relationship between those two? N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, this is N2XJN. There are three major roots of perpetual motion over units that people are seeking for. One of them is HHO, which is actually converting H2O, which is the water, to the gaseous substance, where you have two atoms of hydrogen and one atom of oxygen. And the HHO then, that is produced from water, that in the packet of water you have two electrodes and it's being powered from the battery. Then this HHO actually, with the closed cover of that bucket, is being delivered through the holes to the engine, inlet of the engine, and powering the engine. That's one of the approaches. The second of the approaches is the neodymium magnet motors. Well, there's one factor that is strange. Kinetic energy and the potential energy of two magnets in vertical position. After 10 years, when you have these two magnets in vertical position with the same poles towards themselves, you find them almost in the same position. And if we say that each magnet weighs 10 pounds, that we cannot strictly say that this is a potential energy, because this energy works, and this is a kinetic energy. So now, if we try to measure force, that force has to come with any kind of measurement, joules, watt, whatever you want to name it, newtons. And then, when you get into that point, let me drop. Okay. When you get into that point, you say, well, this thing is constantly working. So why this energy is not much being used? So that would drive people to construct neodymium magnet motors that actually could work by themselves. The third approach is the Tesla coil. When the Tesla in 1897 approached J.P. Morgan, and he stated that he wants to deliver free energy, electricity for everybody, he was ruined by J.P. Morgan. And he had only a limited amount of money coming from the Nobel Prize and his other inventions to live the way that he was. But actually, he was living a poor man life. Let me drop. Now, the device that I have on my desk, it's a simple idea of the device that will have no need for any kind of analysis, because when you disconnect the power supply and the system works by itself, then you don't need anybody to just do not believe that it's not working. And whichever principles this device uses, stealing energy from the earth of any way, I don't have a problem with that. The only thing is that so far we are at the stage that I have connected two channels of the oscilloscope, and one channel is connected to the base of the transistor in the generating circuitry that is actually keying up the Tesla coil. Actually, it is not the Tesla coil, it's the high voltage transformer. Then at the secondary of the high voltage transformer on the high, I have a very strange looking coil, a kind of transformer of thyroids inside, and the thyroids, they don't create a loop like a typical ferrite core for the transformer. It's a straight row of 16 ferrites. Using this circuit, when I connected high voltage probe, and the voltage, it looks like it's 4,000 volts only, by using the Tektronix high voltage probe for the oscilloscope. I was comparing these two signals together, and a strange ringing pattern. Actually was very much aligned with another pattern, looks like triangle with one straight line, the vertical, that contains with the very small, the same one. So it's a kind of very strong, strange signal, and so far I didn't get the ability to light up the 200 watt bulb from that, but as I say, the person who cooperates with me, and he has the same principles, find out if it's true and deliver this technology, if it's possible, and we don't seek any financial, any patents for it. It's just that we want to know. He was able actually to achieve that. He didn't look that to the point that you do not need any external power supply, but when you have a few watts, and then you create 200 watts, and you can for a very significant amount of time power up the bulb. For me, it's something, and because he was more advanced, because he had the original Russian ferrites. The American-made ferrites do not work for some reason this the same way, and I would appreciate if this is the chemical kind. A composition of this ferrite, I don't know. But so far we are at that stage. So, I'm not claiming that I achieved something. I don't claim anything. I say, that's what I observed, that's what is here, and that's where we are, as I promised to you. What I think I'm looking for the answer for is, since my digital multimeter is very precise, laboratory grade, they don't want to show the voltage, even though that the voltage should be much below 4,000 volts, I assume that it's around 200 volts maximum. We have two factors for the voltmeters. The frequency of measurement of that voltage, and we have also the way that these digital multimeters are made, where the overwhelming them, they're with the all of the frequency coming from that a very much broad RF signal, actually make them not showing the voltage at all, none of them. So, I have two military voltmeters. I didn't try them yet. And my question is, I remember your words, Dick, what you said. The tube voltmeters are the best in this field. What would be then that I put in between the 1,000 volt analog voltmeter and the source of 4, 5, up to 10 kilovolts high voltage in order to get a precise measurement? Would that be voltage divider? Back to you and to Exxon.
PC2WGB comment.
WDG I think it is, and I'll get to you in a second. What you're trying to do, Wesley, is not easy, as you're discovering. Multimeters, volt-ohm millimeters, digital voltmeters have a great deal of difficulty measuring AC voltages that are beyond, oh, let me pick a number, 100 kilohertz. As you start approaching a megacycle and beyond, most digital voltmeters and volt-ohm milliammeters will not read correctly, and the data sheet from the manufacturer will probably indicate that. There are special high-voltage probes you can buy for certain kinds of vacuum tube voltmeters that will allow you to measure voltage of an RF signal, if and only if the signal is steady state, like a continuous 10 megacycle sine wave. But when it comes to the nonlinear, highly damped, spiky waveform that you get from, say, the discharge of a Tesla coil, let me drop, It is my belief that no normal voltmeter, not even a peak indicating voltmeter, can tell you what is exactly happening. It is my guess that the best you're going to get is an extremely high frequency, well calibrated oscilloscope, because the nice thing about an oscilloscope is it has no real inertia to it. If it's a high enough frequency responding oscilloscope, and you're just deflecting an electron beam that goes to that screen, that cathode ray tube, it can show you rather precisely the peak voltage, the rate of decay and whatever, if it is connected to a probe that itself covers that frequency region, and if the probe itself is far enough away from the Tesla coil that it's making an indirect measurement. Almost any probe that I can think of that you connect directly to a Tesla coil output, the high voltage output, let me drop, that probe and that voltage divider network is going to disturb the living daylights out of the Tesla coil and change the magnitude of what it's really doing. It's going to give you what's sort of like a Heisenberg uncertainty principle, which suggests that when you're down to the molecular level, even though you're not, that any method of making a measurement is going to disturb the measurement itself, is one way of stating it. And one other thing worth considering, that one of the roads that I've gone down, put this in the back of your mind, is that there's a significant difference in high voltage phenomena if the high voltage is an AC voltage versus a DC voltage. A Tesla coil secondary output is primarily an AC damped wave. In other words, if your particular Tesla coil puts out at the first instant a plus 200,000 volt spike, and the next half instant it's going to put out a minus 200,000 volt spike.
I don't have any high volt, any AC at all. I operate on DC. Spark actually gave me the ability to transfer to from one coil to another.
Even though you're starting off with DC, the actual spark itself, obvious by what you've seen on that oscilloscope, is a damp sine wave. There is an AC component to it. And if you were generating the DC voltage directly by way of a Wimhurst machine or a Van de Graaff generator, either of those machines make pure high voltage direct current. My experiments have shown that direct current behaves very differently than alternating current. A spark discharge, you may think it is going to the primary of a transformer and then the secondary is giving you the high voltage. Well, almost always that transformer rings and it really, the secondary is generating an AC voltage. That's my belief.
The generator is giving me a pulse. That pulse actually is taxing the primary coil of high voltage transformer. Secondary voltage transformer has that spark. Back to you.
Okay, by way of the proper kinds of oscilloscope measurements, you will be able to confirm whether or not the DC current that you put into the primary and whether or not you get a spark out of the secondary, and does that secondary winding ring and make a AC voltage, even if it's a non-symmetric AC voltage. That's one of the things you're going to want to know about. And one of the things I've discovered is that when you're doing high voltage DC measurements, the positive and negative terminal behave very differently, depending on which one comes closer to the other one. In other words, if you've got two probes that are each with high voltage on them, each one, let's say, 4 inches long, and if you aim the tip of the positive one toward the middle of the shaft of the negative one, you'll get a very different response than if you do the opposite. How big a voltage you can put and when the air breaks down and how much corona discharge you get is very different. The negative electrons that are on the negative lead are extremely mobile compared to the positive ions that are on the positive lead. And so if the positive lead is the one that's aimed toward the shaft of the negative, you can get a much bigger, more intense spark. A much higher voltage takes place before discharge takes place. So DC behaves very differently than AC. It's one of the things I'm going to throw in. I've got some guesses as to why all that takes place. You're in a difficult area, but your biggest problem, as I see it, is making sure that your instrumentation does not load down or contaminate the phenomena you're trying to measure. It is my belief that your oscilloscope, properly used with the right kind of probe, is going to give you the most truthful answer. It is my belief that your volt-ohm-milliammeter, vacuum-tube-voltmeter, and digital-voltmeter doesn't stand a chance to give accurate measurements in the phenomena that I think you're looking for. That's my first guess. I could be wrong, but I think they're never going to be able to see the right voltage because the phenomena you're looking for is too brief compared to their normal period of operation, so to speak. Mr. WDG, give me the full call letters and your name, sir, and go right ahead with your comment. KQRIW, my name is Dick.
WS2N, also a comment.
Paul recognized. Mr. WDG, your name and call, sir.
Good evening, Dick, and everybody on the net. This is KC2WGB, Whiskey Golf Bravo. Name is John. Dick, I was just wondering if I was involved in a testing procedure one time where we used dielectric breakdown of mylar to vacuum. I don't know if that would work, but it got us pretty close to the actual predicted voltage ranges. So just kick that around.
Okay, KC2, Whiskey Golf Delta. I think we got it that right time, that right, John. Without a doubt, air and high voltage has some peculiar characteristics. And you ask the average person, why, if I have two probes that are breaking down in a bell jar, and I measure 30 volts per centimeter, and then I start evacuating the air out of the bell jar, and I find out that a much, much lower voltage will give me the exact same breakdown. Air at room pressure is good for 30 volts per centimeter, 30 kilovolts per centimeter, and go to the equivalent of 30,000 feet. I'm not sure the exact number, but maybe it's only 10,000 volts per centimeter instead of 30,000. Air's got this peculiar characteristic that it breaks down more easily at lower air pressure, and then as you go to even less air pressure, as you start going toward vacuum, all of a sudden the breakdown voltage again starts climbing to a much, much higher voltage. It gives you a bathtub-shaped curve. I'm trying to think of the name of the guy who actually first did that curve. Can't think of his name right now. But anyhow, this was very well documented in the beginning of the 20th century, and I now think I've got a partial understanding for what's going on there. So if you were trying to measure the dielectric strength of mylar, and you did it in a vacuum environment as opposed to an air environment, you stand much more of a chance of measuring what the mylar is doing versus what the air around the mylar is doing. That's what I think you're indicating, John, and that's a good attempt. And somebody's eventually going to mention the name of the guy who did all these high-voltage experiments and came up with this classic curve of breakdown voltage versus air pressure. Well, we'll eventually come up with it. Paul, WS2N, go right ahead with your question. K2RIW in the TechNet.
W2JPW, comment.
JPW recognized. Paul first.
Okay, Dick. The best example I've seen with the difference between positive and negative, and of course with AC, is if you take a welding machine and hook it up in the DC fashion, so you have either straight polarity or reverse polarity, one side being positive and the other side being negative, and in the next test you reverse that. It's an amazing thing to watch. If you take two electrodes, two identical electrodes, or they could be 10 inches long to start, or any distance, two identical electrodes, and you hook them up to a welding machine that's in DC, one side is positive and the other side is negative, and they usually run around 24 volts, and you set it at a certain amperage, say 80 or 90 amps, and you put these two electrodes toward each other and let them burn, let them ignite and let them burn down. You'll see the one side, the positive side, burning down much more. You do that for, let's say, 15, 20 seconds, and you'll see that the positive side is burned down much more than the negative side. So the negative electrons are really flying off the negative side. And then you reverse that, put it on the reverse polarity instead of straight polarity. Let me drop it. And you take two more identical electrodes, and you put them up and you start the arc between them, and you run it for roughly about the same amount of time, and you'll see that the one that on your left-hand side that was negative originally, now it's positive, will be the one that will burn down quite a bit. Like, you measure it, and if you start it off, let's say, with 10-inch long rods, you're going to find one is like 7 inches and the other one is like 5 inches or 4 inches. It's a big difference. And then if you have a nice machine where you could switch over to AC, you put it on the AC setting, and you strike an arc between two identical electrodes that you would normally use for welding, and you let that go, you're going to see that after, 10, 20, 30 seconds, you shut it off, you look at it, and they're going to be exactly the same length as the one on the left-hand side or the right-hand side deck. So it's just an interesting experiment that I've done. I heard about it, and I've done it quite a few times just for fun. It's amazing. Back to you, Dick.
Fantastic, Paul. Paul, there's a lot of science in what you've just described. I'd love to really know, at the molecular level, what is taking place when you reverse the polarity on your welding machine. I know you do welding as an occupation, so you've seen it firsthand, but what's happening at the molecular level? By the way, that air breakdown curve, I've been trying to think of the name of it, is called Paschen. P-A-S-C-H-E-N. Mr. Paschen, I think, invented that curve. If you just Google the word Paschen curve, you'll see this bathtub-shaped curve, which shows around 30,000 volts per centimeter is the dielectric strength of air at sea level pressure. But if you go to 150,000 feet, 1 millimeter of mercury instead of 760 millimeters of mercury air pressure, it goes down to, what am I looking at here? Wow. Looks like around 300 volts per centimeter instead of 30,000 volts per centimeter. That's a 100-to-1 change. In other words, air breaks down 100 times easier at low air pressure, equal to about 150,000 foot of altitude. That's what the Paschen curve is showing. And then as you start going to better vacuums than that, the curve starts curving, starts climbing very rapidly. My study of air molecules in the last few months have given me a little bit more understanding of what's happening. And one of my physics puzzles that I've often asked people, I know this is a little off to one side, let me drop.
I mean, it's more along with a question with this comment, with this subject.
Okay, get to you in a second there, Joe. One of the questions in my puzzles that I've asked people that think they understand physics is, why does the bottom of your bicycle pump get hot? Everybody comes out with the answer of conservation of energy, PV equals NRT. Those two answers tell you how much. They do not tell you why. And I wanted to know why. And when you get to the molecular level as to why does the bottom of your bicycle pump get hot, you'll never believe what the answer is. What I'm 90% sure I think I know what the answer is. No book explains that. No class I've ever taken in thermodynamics has ever explained that. PV equals NRT and conservation of energy tells you how much, tells you from a black box point of view what's happening. Doesn't tell you why. I mean, when you say the air is higher in temperature, let me drop. That's a fancy way of saying that the individual air molecules have more kinetic energy. That's a fancy way of saying 1/2 mv². They're moving faster. Their average speed is greater. Okay, who speeded them up? What made them decide to move faster? PV equals NRT tells you how much. Doesn't tell you how. Doesn't tell you why. I think I know why. And that gives me a little bit more understanding of what happens with high voltage phenomena with air. And that's something that I definitely want to know about. And whenever air breaks down, it makes all kinds of frequencies, all kinds of air. When it breaks down, when it gives you a spark or an arc, is the most nonlinear process in the world. Once that spark has formed and you increase the current flowing through that spark, any normal resistor, you increase the current through it, the voltage drop across the resistor increases. You do that with an arc in air, and the opposite happens. The higher the current you put through the arc, the lower is the voltage drop across the arc. More current makes less voltage. Crazy. Extremely nonlinear. I think I have partial understanding for why. And a Tesla coil, to some degree, is using that phenomenon when you see the beautiful discharge going on with a Tesla coil. Joe had a question, but he's right after Lou. Lou asked first. W2JPW, go ahead, Lou, with your question or comment. K2RIW and Techman. We're getting down to some basic physics tonight here, Lou.
Yeah, this is fun. I always loved to experiment with high voltage when I was young. W2JPW here on TechNet. My question is he trying to measure? The peak voltage from the Tesla coil. Why not just get a set of cables? I imagine that if you look hard enough, you can find them. Atmospheric pressure and relative humidity and spark length. You would have to calculate the spark length depending on the size of, if you're using two spheres, say two spheres of a millimeter in diameter or a half a centimeter, that would give you that. I think I've seen this in some old books, but I can't really pinpoint it, but I know it's out there. There are several very comprehensive books written before 1920 on electricity and elementary experiments in electricity and magnetism, where all these high voltage phenomena were discussed at great length. Let me drop it. Sure, I don't overtime the repeater. Second thing, if you could do it with an oscilloscope, maybe the Tektronix used to have an old oscilloscope, especially for this. It was called the 507. I think that was what it was. It was for high voltage transient. It was a scope designed for work with transients and analyzing various kinds of pulses and transient responses. I think the power industry used to use this a lot. Probably find one somewhere in the surplus market for a pretty reasonable price nowadays. And you could use some sort of calculations from an elementary book on electricity and magnetism to figure out, derive what the voltage is at your Tesla coil. That's my comment. I think I figured out your bicycle pump, but I have to think about it a little more. Go ahead, Dick.
Each time we drop the machine, we have to wait until we hear a beep, Lou, otherwise it might not get reset. If you simply Google the word high voltage experiments, and I've done that lots of times in the last year, you'll get a zillion websites. And you go to those websites, you're absolutely right, Lou. There's a whole lot of empirical data that has been derived where if you know the diameter of the two spheres of your high voltage probes that you bring in close to each other, if you know the diameter and you know the spacing, it is extremely predictable in air where the breakdown will take place. So if you wanted to measure peak voltage by that means, I think you could probably get 5% voltage accuracy at the kilovolt level, up to megavolts if you wanted to, by using the right diameter spheres and the right spacing. The slight problem with that is that as you bring two spheres close together like that, in order to measure the voltage, you are creating an extra capacitance to your circuit, and that extra capacitance is loading the circuit, and therefore you're creating this Heisenberg uncertainty principle. But you're absolutely right that the right kind of oscilloscope, let me drop, when it comes to instrumentation for measuring transient high voltage phenomena, it is my belief you cannot beat a fast acting oscilloscope with the right kind of a probe. And the probe itself of the oscilloscope does not have to directly connect to the end of your Tesla coil, for instance, which would be loading it down. With the right kind of calibration procedure, when you've got voltages of that magnitude, you could stand 1 foot away, maybe even 5 foot away from the apparatus, and still quantify with reasonably high accuracy for what voltage was present, and now you would not be loading the circuit. So measuring the voltage, the peak voltage, measuring the waveform, I think the oscilloscope is your best instrument. And after you've quantified it with an oscilloscope, there are ways you can make very fast-acting sample and hold circuits that will measure your peak voltage for you, again with a large spacing, so you're not loading it down. Capacitive divider network, high-voltage probes, my best belief as a way to do it, better than a resistor divider probe, because
when you're measuring hundreds of kilovolts, for instance, and that's what really does take place from the average Tesla coil, hundreds of thousands of volts is what I'm trying to say,